Mark Katz was not your normal kid. For fun, he watched the Nixon debates on TV, then wrote jokes about it. It was the beginning of a career that would eventually land him a job as joke writer for the Clinton White House. In his memoir, Clinton and Me, Katz talks about weathering the Lewinsky scandal, helping Al Gore find the funny, and the time he helped Bill Clinton make friends with self-deprecating humor.
In January of 1995, he gave a State of the Union address that was very long, hour and a half long. You look over his shoulder, even Al Gore was nodding off. But he was trying to do something. You know, this was just a few months after Newt Gingrich in the 105th Congress. He was basically trying to steal back his own agenda. So he'd put together such an ambitious speech that it went on for an hour and a half. And he was getting grief for that. And that felt like yet another missed opportunity in what was becoming, you know, a missed opportunity of a presidency. At that moment in time, he seemed like he was limping towards one term. So I, that very week, was the Alfalfa Club. He gave the State of the Union on Tuesday. Alfalfa was Saturday night. By Wednesday, around noon, I came up with the idea that he should walk to the podium of this room where 300 of the most important people in Washington are sitting there waiting to hear from the president.
And not just 300 of the most important people, but 300 people he really didn't like.
That's right. Well, the Alfalfa Club is more corporate. It's actually not a press dinner. It's kind of a more of a corporate dinner. And he didn't have warm feelings for the constituent of that particular club. So he wasn't especially happy about going.
So he wasn't fired with a desire to make them laugh.
Or please them or win them over. And the idea that I had was he would walk to the podium, pull an egg timer from his pocket, set it to 5 minutes, and put it on the corner of the podium, which only set up, one, get that laugh, you know, a self-directed laugh, and two, set up a better joke to come, which is at the end of 5 minutes, keep on adding time to the timer for as many times as he wants. It was a big laugh each time, or so I imagined, except that in the half hour before he was about to give the speech, we were going to go over it for the very first time. And he walked into a holding room in the Capitol Hilton, and the first words he said to me that night was, "You can put that egg timer away." He was not happy with the premise of it, wasn't happy to concede what it conceded, didn't care for it one bit.
And he felt that that long speech was a valuable speech, full of good ideas,
right,
and people shouldn't be making fun of it.
And by the way, he got a lot of applause in that speech. Why should that be held against him, you know? So, no, he didn't want to concede the point. And didn't want to do that joke. And it was a tense, angry meeting. Oddly angry for, you know, a humor writer in a room with him. And as I tried to kind of convince him of what had yet been self-evident to him, he walked out of the room. And I thought I wrote the last speech I was ever going to write for him. And I found the courage. I gave the egg timer to an advance aide and said, "The president's going to need this up on the podium." Even though I knew how strongly he had vetoed the idea. Because honestly, I didn't know what speech he was going to give. And figuring it was
without
my last
egg timer, half the jokes were gone.
It was the organizing principle of the speech. So as it turned out, he was up there rewriting the speech during most of the dinner and got up and gave the speech he wrote on the dais. And it didn't go over very well. It was meaner than it needed to be. It was less self-gracious, certainly not self-effacing. In fact, some people wondered if he knew the theme of the evening was humor at all. And as the speech went on, and as he could tell he was dying up there, and the red lights in his mind must have been flashing, he reached into his pocket and said, "Maybe this'll help." And he pulled out an egg timer and got the one good laugh of the night. But the night was a disaster. It really was.
That was an argument, if there ever was one, for a presidential joke writer.
Okay, yes. I didn't put that in so many words, but I'll be happy to hear you say it. I got back up to New York, and he admits, you know, that I felt, in even addition to the State of the Union address, to me, the Alfalfa dinner that night was the missed opportunity for him from the point of view of humor and kind of, you know, taking your medicine and really not just taking your medicine, but it actually there's a lot of tactical advantage in self-directed humor. And he missed an opportunity to be the biggest person in that room mm-hmm. that night and really missed an opportunity for what I hoped would be a shining moment for him. But the shining moment came a little later in the week when I got a note, a handwritten note from him that said, "Dear Mark, thanks for your help with the alfalfa dinner. The egg timer was great. Best, Bill Clinton." Which was, you know.
You have that framed and hung on the wall.
I absolutely have it framed and hung on the wall. And it was a wonderful note. And it was, you know, there was subtext to it. You know, a president doesn't come out and say, you know, I'm sorry or what have you. But, you know, that note was all he needed to say. And it was.
And it brought you back to write more jokes for him.
That's right. I went on. And it really was a turning point, I think. In one, our relationship, you know, he never again did we have such a tense meeting. And two, you know, his relationship to humor that he understood and he'd learned this lesson the hard way that, you know, humor is best used when self-directed. I have three rules of humor that I'll share with you. Rule number one of political humor, be self-deprecating. Number two, repeat as necessary. And number three, once you have been sufficiently self-deprecating, you have acquired the right to be self-deprecating on behalf of others.
Now, you must have learned quite a bit of this earlier in your career. You did, after all, write jokes for Michael Dukakis, who is not remembered as... Well, he is remembered as somebody who was perhaps deserving of quite a lot of self-deprecating.
Yeah, no, you're looking at the man who made Mike Dukakis so funny. So,
you're not the man who put him in the tank, though.
No, but I get that question twice a week. And no, the Dukakis campaign did not work out as we had hoped, as you may remember. And yes, we did generate unintentional laughs. But even to this day, and it was my job. That was my first job out of college.
What did you write for him, for instance?
Well, we wrote hundreds of jokes. Just off the top of my head, I remember, "Hi, I'm Mike Dukakis, and these are my eyebrows."
Did he deliver that?
No, never once.
Okay.
But... my job, I showed up there as a volunteer and was clipping newspapers at 5 in the morning. You know, I was a year or so out of college and was one of many over-eager, over-ambitious 23-year-olds who show up on campaigns. And I had an amazing experience on that campaign.
Is it your experience that politicians recognize the value of humor but don't see that... it's necessary for them?
That's exactly right. They all understand exactly what I say to you in the abstract, but you try to get any given politician to concede a painful truth on any given day, and you'll know what, you know, I've been up against sometimes. Mm.
Now,
and I'm not talking
was...
just about the president. I'm talking about lots of different people.
Well, there's a story in here that it suggests that maybe the exception to that rule was Al Gore.
That's right. You're a careful reader, because Al Gore is unlike any public person I've worked with, because he is fearlessly self-effacing and was willing to do just about any joke and knew had one has a very good sense of humor. And I did maybe half a dozen speeches for him, and we constantly took advantage of the disparity between how he is perceived and his genuine and heightened sense of humor. So he had that secret weapon, and that allowed us and his team and working with his speechwriters to arrive at a very funny comic persona, Gridiron Al, I call him. And America saw him on Saturday Night Live, Gridiron Al. This self-effacing, very charming, you know, very funny man who is fearless in what he's willing to say about himself.
One of the stories that actually makes him sound even more appealing is that there are jokes that maybe you've gotten credit for that may have actually been his.
Well, I'll tell you, there's a couple stories. One great with him, we did very well with kind of opening bits at the Gridiron. And one of the bits was, and this is an idea that I can only take half credit for, but he didn't know it. He actually came up with the other half. He said to me, "Do you have any ideas for what we might do as an opening bit?" The bit is kind of a comedy term for, you know, shtick, or for lack of a better word. And I said, just as an ice-breaking, off-the-top-of-my-head joke, I said, "Yeah, we're going to reel you out to the podium on a hand truck." Okay. Well, he says, "Oh, I love it." And as he's responding, I'm engaging this furious internal monologue saying, "You know what? I must have actually been serious when I said that." And, you know, I may have come up with the joke, but Al Gore actually had the idea. And I did. At that moment, I kind of pretended that, "Oh, yes, that's my idea. Of course. Yes, Mr. Vice President, that's what we're going to do. I've already spoken to the hand truck guy," you know, whatever.
This all, of course, had to do with Al Gore being perceived as having a very wooden personality.
That's right.
And you used that.
Well, and more importantly, he used it. I mean, it's one thing for a wise ass to stare into a computer screen and write jokes. It's quite another for a person to walk to that podium and stand in front of, you know, the press corps and the people who judge him and concede these things. So, you know, I think it's important to remember the act of courage it takes for these people. And some people meet it better than others. And I think Al Gore was as fearless and as courageous as any public person I've ever worked with.
You were around when the impeachment process was going on?
It's all a blur, but I think the answer is yes. Yes, we had to figure out how to...
You don't think of that time as a time when there were jokes being told by the president?
No, it was a very difficult time, and it really kind of put the comedy war room to the test. I mean, what does a president say as he's being impeached? There really wasn't a lot to go on.
What does a president say when he's being impeached?
We had arrived at a rule that saw us through this crisis, which was we can do jokes about the smoke and not the fire, which is to say we could do jokes about the hoopla of impeachment and not kind of the specific indiscretions that brought us to the brink of constitutional crisis. So that was the bright line distinction that we arrived at that helped him, you know. And by the way, here's a man who showed up. He, you know, as all these scurrilous charges are being leveled against him, as he's denying them, as his world seems to be imploding, here's a guy who did show up at the Gridiron Dinner that year, who did show up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner year. That's no small act of courage. And how he handled it, the Gridiron Club that year, if you remember, he really wasn't saying very much. He was basically saying, I can't say, I've told you everything I can say. My lawyers have told me I can't say any more. So what we did was I came up with an idea working with my brother, who's a professor of law. Here's the speech my lawyers wrote for me. Here's the funny speech my lawyers wrote for me. And that was a funny comic premise that got him through, you know, a difficult day and really just earned him the applause for having the courage to show up, which he deserved. And at the White House Correspondents' Dinner that year, I'm trying to remember what he did. But it was, you know, it was, again, more about the smoke than the fire. And he did show up. And he had an uninterrupted appearance. You know, he showed up every year for 8 years at the Gridiron and at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And at his last appearance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, I wanted to work that into the speech because I thought that was really a test of character that he passed with flying colors.
But he wouldn't do it.
No. We did do the joke. I'll tell you the joke. And here's a line I was very pleased because it wasn't even a joke as much as kind of I wanted him to get the applause because I thought he'd earned this applause. And I wrote him an applause line, which is, you know, through times of great controversy and accomplishment, you know, I showed up here no matter what. And he got the applause of, you know, 3,000 of the White House correspondents. And then the kicker was, looking back, that was probably a mistake. But you know what? It wasn't a mistake. And he knew it wasn't a mistake. You know, that was a joke because the right answer was to show up and to show kind of the strength of character to stand in the middle of that room no matter, you know, and show that he was willing to stand on his own 2 feet in front of these people and take it. And he's a man with enormous resilience. More, you know, if what had happened in 1998 would have happened to, well, I'll just speak for me, you know, I would have resigned within 20 minutes of having the distinguishing characteristics of my private parts, you know, published to the world. But he's a resilient man. And ultimately, you know, he's made it through and completed his presidency on a high note. But humor allowed him to get through that rough patch.
Mark Katz was Clinton's joke writer. He's the author of the book Clinton and Me.